Okay, folks, I think we'll get started. Lots of familiar faces. So thanks for coming to this third session of my series on Eco-Reformation. I should say for the tape, which I forgot to do last time, my name is Jim Martin Schramm, and I'm a professor of religion at Luther College in Decorah. So I've been working through this theme of Eco-Reformation this week, and today I'm going to conclude with a sort of summary of the essay I have in the book by this series name, Eco-Reformation, Grace and Hope for a Planet in Peril, that Lisa Dayhill and I co-edited back in 2016. And so today I'm going to focus on Dietrich Bonhoeffer. How many of you are familiar with Dietrich Bonhoeffer? Raise your hands. Yeah. So, you know, maybe two-thirds of you, but some folks not at all. And so what I'm going to do, this session is trying to drag Bonhoeffer in the 21st century, maybe inappropriately, but nevertheless, I'm going to do it anyway. And so I'm going to work with an essay, a famous essay he wrote in 1933 called The Church and the Jewish Question. Look at the three responses he thought the church had in relationship to the state about dealing with Nazism and its impact on Jews, and then look at those three responses in relationship to climate change today. If the Jewish question was the most important issue facing Bonhoeffer in the 30s and 40s, I guess the argument I'm going to make is that climate change is the most important issue facing us today. I talked a little bit about that on the very first day, and so I'm going to repeat some of that information for the benefit of those who weren't here, but I'll move a little more quickly through it. First, however, I think I'll just begin with a little bit of an overview of Bonhoeffer so that you have some sense of who this dude is, and we'll go from there. This is him at age 21. He has just finished his first dissertation. His first dissertation. You have to write two dissertations to become a professor in a university. So not only has he completed his undergraduate studies, he's also completed his first doctoral exam. Born in February 4th, 1906, executed in Flossenbürg, which was a slave labor camp, just 2 weeks before the Allies liberated the camp in 1945. I stole this from Cheryl's emphasis on multiplicity. And, you know, the more I heard her talk about it, the more I thought, oh, this absolutely fits Bonhoeffer. Without question, a privileged male. The very first slide I put up in front of my students when I teach my course on Bonhoeffer is, what will you do with your power and privilege? Because Bonhoeffer had a lot of both. And so I don't have time to go into all of that today, but I'll just sort of hit a few things here. He was a twin. He had seven siblings. He was the youngest son out of a set of only Carl Friedrich, the eldest brother, survived the war. Klaus was shot in the back of the head for also participating in the conspiracy, and his brother Walter died in the First World War, and this had an enormous effect on Bonhoeffer, and some scholars think led him to think about ministry. But he had a twin sister, and he was born 10 minutes before Sabina. Sabina grows up to marry Gerhard Leipholz. Gerhard is a Christian, but he's his parents are Jewish. He was a baptized Christian, but his parents were Jewish, and thus under the German Aryan ancestry rules, Gerhard Leipholz was Jewish. And so he would later be imperiled by all of the various kinds of discrimination that was imposed on them. He was a fabulous musician. At the age of 14, his parents brought him in to sit with a master pianist to assess whether Bonhoeffer had the chops to actually go on to be a performer at the highest level. He was performing Mozart sonatas at age 13. Incredible musician, youth worker. Children loved this guy. He was like a magnet. And it didn't matter if they were really young or if they were college students. Youth flocked to the man. He had a charisma and just a genuine caring for everybody, but especially for children. He's executed at age 39, so doesn't have a very long life. He had some experience of what it felt to be a social worker when he was an intern pastor in Barcelona during the Great Depression. While he's definitely from the upper middle class, never had to worry about where his next meal was coming from, he certainly knew plenty of people who did and had personal relationships with many of them as a parish pastor. He also, going back to the youth worker thing, worked with a group of really tough kids in a neighborhood full of communists in East Berlin. And the funding for there was a project of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Do any of you know that organization? It's a pacifist organization that practices creative nonviolent resistance, tries to anticipate problems before they occur. Anyway, the primary benefactor behind that project was a Jewish friend of the family. So Bonhoeffer's brother-in-law, Gerhard Leipholz, is Jewish in the eyes of Germany. One of his financial benefactors in Berlin was Jewish. And his best friend, Franz Hildebrandt, is in the same boat as Gerhard Leipholz. He also was deemed Jewish. And all of those people had to flee Germany by 1936. I've mentioned the fact that he was a pastor for a while. He was a professor. He ran the Finkenwalde Seminary, a very unique approach to seminary education. Many view him as a prophet in terms of anticipating what was going to happen in Germany. He was a friend. This is Eberhard Betzke, Bonhoeffer's biographer and best friend throughout his life. They met each other at Finkenwalde. Eberhard was a little older than Dietrich. He had been kicked out of the seminary in Wittenberg because he refused to take an oath of loyalty to Adolf Hitler. He came to Finkenwalde to continue his seminary education, and he said, wo bist der Direktor? Where is the director of the seminary? And the guy said, he's out there. This was before they started at a beach resort. Well, that's such a great resort, but it was on the beach. And here's Bonhoeffer out there playing soccer. And one of the guys says, well, it's him. Who, him? Yeah. And Bonhoeffer looks so young and vigorous. And first of all, professors didn't play football with their students. Anyway, lifelong friendship, worth exploring on its own. Really interesting theologian. Cost of Discipleship is a book-long treatment, a series of reflections on the Sermon on the Mount. Life Together is a brief synopsis of what it felt like to live in Christian community at Finkenwalde Seminary. His book Ethics is an attempt to try to put down his approach to ethics, very different kind of genre, and the Letters and Papers from Prison. He's in prison for 2 years, and we have a wide variety of literature from that period of time. Strong champion of ecumenism, wanted the church to preach the gospel of peace, got thoroughly disgusted with the World Alliance of Churches that is now the World Council of Churches because it refused to take a stand against National Social, or it refused to kick out the German Christians. How do I say this? It'll become clear in a minute. In my view, he's a pacifist for most of his life. But eventually, when all attempts at nonviolent resistance are really at an end, his brother-in-law, Hans von Dohnányi, recruits him to join a conspiracy that is centered in what's called the Abwehr, the German counterintelligence office. And Bonhoeffer is valued by them because he has lots of international contacts, and the conspirators need to be able to communicate with the Allies. And so Bonhoeffer is brought in to serve in that sort of intermediary role. But to be sure, he never pulled a trigger. He never was part of any attempt to kill Hitler. He was part of the group that tried to kill Hitler 3 times and failed. And he was a good poet. Finally, he was a lover. This is Maria von Wiedemeyer in the bottom right-hand corner. Now, you know, you can think what you want. Dietrich was 36 and she was 18. Eberhard gets engaged to Bonhoeffer's niece, Renata, when Renata is 17. Different world, different time, hell all around you. Anyway, wonderful woman. Bonhoeffer had a tiger by the tail there. She survives the war, goes through two husbands, winds up being the first really female executive in the computer science industry. I don't think Bonhoeffer had any idea what he was in for there. All right, quickly. These are big questions that Bonhoeffer's thinking about throughout his life. Is the religion called Christianity fading into irrelevance? He looks at Gandhi's movement in India and their act of nonviolent resistance, and he says to his brother, I think Gandhi and his followers have more in common with Jesus Christ than the church, the Protestant Church of Germany. He actually puts it more strongly than that. He says the form Christ is taking in the world might be more associated with Gandhi and his movement than can be found in our country. Has religion as routine and custom replaced faith and discipleship? Bonhoeffer hammers away at discipleship. Pick up your cross and follow me, Jesus says. So Bonhoeffer asks that question, who is Jesus Christ for us today? What is the responsibility of Christians in the modern world? And could a religionless Christianity restore the vitality and the mission of the church? The title of my course at Luther used to be Dietrich Bonhoeffer, but anymore, young folks don't really know who he is. And so I've retitled it Religionless Christianity, : The Life and Thought of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And turns out, then I get students that are interested. So it's a provocative idea that I'm not going to get into today. So Adolf Hitler comes to power in January of 1933. He swept into power in large measure because of the radical demoralization of Germany after the First World War, the economic conditions in the country, people yearning for the basically to return to the days of the monarchy under the Kaiser. And there's a group of German Christians, most of the Protestant church in Germany, that self-identify themselves as Deutsche Christen, German Christians. And they very quickly sought to hitch their wagon to the success of Adolf Hitler and National Socialism. And so here's their official flag. Yeah, thanks, Eric. I wasn't sure if that would glare too much. I mean, I don't need to explain this. Deutsche Christen, right? And here's our friend, the swastika, right in the middle. You can't read this here. I'm sorry, these pictures are from a book by Eberhard Bethke, edited by Bethke, called Dietrich Bonhoeffer, A Life in Pictures. Anyway, what it says here on the altar pyramid is Ein Volk, ein Blut. What is that? One people, one blood. Is that what the Church of Jesus Christ says? What do we say? One baptism, one faith, or one baptism, one church. We're all members of the church by virtue of our baptism into Jesus, into Christ. We are not members of the church by virtue of our race or our class or our gender. In Christianity, there's one thing that makes you a member of the church and one thing only, and that's baptism. And so Bonhoeffer, when the church wanted to impose the Arian ideology on the church, Bonhoeffer, this wasn't up for debate. You either believe that the only thing that unites Christians is baptism, or you don't. And if you don't, you're not part of the church. Hitler takes power in January. The Reichstag burns on February 27th, 1933. This would be like the U.S. Capitol burning to the ground 1 month after we've elected someone to office. Hitler issues this edict for the protection of the people of the state, which abolished almost all constitutional rights for everybody. Became a dictator pretty much overnight. This is what fear not, right, our theme? This is what fear can do. April 1st, national boycott of Jewish stores. Organized national boycott all over Germany. And then on April 7th, which is the thing that I'm finally getting around to here, The Nazi regime, they have a parliament, I forget what they call it, a Reichstag, but it has no teeth. It just takes whatever the Hitler regime says they want, and they rubber stamp it, and off it goes. Well, on April 7th, they passed this law for the reconstruction of the professional service, civil service, which contained the Aryan clause. And basically it meant if you were a civil servant, you had to be an Aryan. And if you're a Jew, you're not an Aryan. And of course, there are lots of other people that wouldn't qualify as Aryans. The majority of the Protestant church wanted to implement this Aryan clause in the church. So Dietrich Bonhoeffer's best friend, Franz Hildebrandt, who has also gone through seminary, wants to be a parish pastor because, even though he's a baptized Christian, because one of his parents is Jewish, that's it. There's no chance that he's going to be a parish pastor in this regime. So, them as fighting words, at least for Bonhoeffer, I don't know if this gets your blood boiling, but it certainly did his. And so April of 1933, the same month that law is passed, Bonhoeffer sits down in front of a group of pastors, a smaller group than this, maybe half our size, and he shares with them his essay, The Church and the Jewish Question. It later gets published in a theological journal in June, and the focus of it is, how should the church judge the actions of the state? How many of you recognize the term the Two Kingdoms Doctrine? Yeah, okay. I'm not going to go into a lot of that, but it's an important teaching in the history of Lutheranism. The problem in Lutheranism is that most Lutherans have divided the church and the state, and there's one set of morality that applies over here and another set of morality that applies over there, and there's a big wall between them, and our country reinforces that with its rhetoric about separating church and state. That is not how Martin Luther envisioned it. Luther envisions these two kingdoms working in complementary ways. God is the creator of the world, establishing the institution of government to restrain the evil that exists within each of us so that we can enjoy a modicum of peace with justice through the coercive power of the sword. Government has the coercive power to throw you in jail, to punish you for doing things wrong. And from Bonhoeffer's perspective, from Martin Luther's perspective, God created the institution of government precisely for that reason, because there's a part of us that we don't always do the good that we seek to do. On the other hand, God creates the institution of the church to promulgate the gospel, to teach love and for forgiveness, and to help the members of the church understand that God has created government for its purpose as well. The church to bring out the best in us, government to restrain what is the worst in us. But the point is, these two are supposed to work together and are not supposed to be independent, and one is not supposed to do the work of the other. And this is where Bonhoeffer got really upset or concerned. This is one of the first public defenses of Jews, both as citizens and as Christians with Jewish heritage. Bonhoeffer, in this essay, condemns state actions which result in too little law. In other words, this revocation of constitutional rights. Bonhoeffer says the state is there to enforce the law. Here you are vitiating the law. There's too little law. You need to do your job and protect constitutional rights. On the other hand, he also condemns state actions that result in too much law when the state starts to interfere in the affairs of the church. We've got our own world over here. Leave us alone. So in the essay, he says to these pastors, here are the ways that he thinks the church as an institution should interact with the institution of the state. One is it should say to the state, are you doing what you're supposed to do? Because it sure doesn't look like it. You've just vitiated the constitutional rights of a huge number of people. It seems to us that you're creating injustice rather than protecting justice. Right there were shifting in the seats and feet starting to shift a little bit on the ground, because this was unusual. This is a country where patriotism runs really deep. And this idea that the church would ever challenge the state was, even though in Luther's mind and Luther's practice, definitely relevant, it was not practiced. And so they're like, oh my God, this is the first of the three things? So then he says, the church has an obligation to serve the victims of state action, and this is his words, regardless whether they are members of the Christian community or not. Everybody knew what that meant. It was a veiled reference to Jews, to communists, to socialists, everybody who had found their rights vitiated. And at this point, half the pastors in the room had left. Think about how mad you have to get. You haven't left yet, so that's good. Wait, there's another half to this presentation. Think about how mad you'd have to get to walk out of a session at Holden or, you know, walk out on one of your colleagues. And then Bonhoeffer lowers the boom and says, if we can't persuade the state to quit violating the law, and if the state keeps producing more and more victims of state action, we may, and Bonhoeffer said, through a church council decision, have to put a spoke in the wheel, put a monkey wrench in the works, in order to bring down the state, in order to preserve the state, and to restore justice. It's hard to kind of grasp how radical that was for the pastor sitting in the room. And maybe you also perceive it as quite radical. But this is what Bonhoeffer said. And in fact, in many respects, this was his life. especially this last little bit, because eventually he gets recruited to participate in the conspiracy and he dies because of his role in it. Roy had this on one of his slides last night about Dorothy Day. Notice the date. This is the London Catholic Worker, spring 2018. The lead story, whose picture? Dietrich. I'm sorry, this is kind of fuzzy, but it's the best we could do. and it's written by Nora Ziegler. I don't know who Nora is. I've read just a little bit of the article. Nora engaged in civil disobedience in the UK at an arms fair where the latest, biggest, and best weapons were on display. And she, as a pacifist, did what she could to disrupt that event. In her mind, she was living up to this sort of piece of advice, response that Bonhoeffer offered. So I'm going to argue, as I said before, that if the Jewish question was the most important issue facing Bonhoeffer in his day, I think climate change is the most important issue facing us today. And I'm going to close by thinking about how Bonhoeffer's three responses might pertain with a focus on the third one, putting a spoke in the wheel. So this is familiar to most of you that were here on, because you were here on Wednesday. So this is just showing you that for the last 800,000 years, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere oscillated between 180 parts per million and 280, or close to 300 parts per million. But since the Industrial Revolution, it has been skyrocketing. And so today, we have reached 410 parts per million. It's actually that right now. I just checked it in May of 2017. And you can see the trajectory. The rate at which carbon dioxide is entering the atmosphere is even faster today than it was three decades ago. I think the slide is self-explanatory. This is out of the Washington Post from an article published yesterday. Probably should have taught this session yesterday. It's pretty bloody hot. So this is from the article. This is a hot, strange, and dangerous summer across the planet. Greece is in mourning after scorching heat and high winds fueled wildfires that have killed more than 80 people. Japan recorded its highest temperature in history, 106 degrees, in a heat wave that killed 65 people in 1 week and hospitalized 22,000. I don't know how to pronounce this country or this city in Algeria, Ouargla. Hit 124 degrees on July 5th, a likely record for the continent of Africa. And the 109-degree reading in Kuryat, Oman, on June 28th amazed meteorologists because that wasn't the day's high, that was the low.
It was the hottest low temperature ever recorded on Earth. Montreal hit 98 degrees on July 2nd, its warmest temperature ever measured. Canadian health officials estimate as many as 70 people died in that heat wave. In the U.S., 35 weather stations in the past month have set new marks for warm overnight temperatures. Southern California has had record heat and widespread power outages. In Yosemite Valley, which is imperiled by wildfires, park rangers have told everyone to flee. The brutal weather has been supercharged by human-induced climate change, scientists say. Climate models for three decades have predicted exactly what the world is seeing this summer, and they predict it will get hotter, and that what is a record today could someday be the norm. Quote, "The old records belong to a world that no longer exists," end quote, said Martin Herling, a research meteorologist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It's a four-page article. That's just a chunk of it that's sobering. Yes, 34?
Yeah.
No idea. I mean, for me, the thing to look at is, you know, from here over, how many are happening in the last 20 years, versus, well, here's this one too. This is in this one. So these two are really the outliers. I don't know what, who's that?
You know how long they've been keeping records for?
I don't. This is National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So, and the reality is those records can be kind of spotty, but it's certainly for the last century.
It's a guess, but 1934 was the rise of the Nazi Party and industrialization in Germany.
It would have been a lot of greenhouse gases going up. Yeah, no idea. In the United States, and, you know, I want to start by saying this, right? This is not a guilt trip. I'm not here to lay guilt on anybody. I flew here. Karen and I flew here from Iowa, and we drove to the airport. We flew all the way to Wenatchee, where we burned carbon every step of the way. In fact, each one of us is contributing about a metric ton of greenhouse gas emissions for this vacation. All of us, whether we like it or not, are in one way or another utterly dependent on the fossil fuel infrastructure of the modern economy. But in the United States, we are one of the world's leading, largest greenhouse emitters of the greenhouse gas that is warming the planet. And it used to be that power generation, electricity, you don't think about it here in the Northwest, but where we live, most of it's normally been produced by the combustion of coal. But now that coal is being replaced by cheap natural gas, and so now transportation fuel is becoming the largest source of carbon dioxide. But here you can see, for the United States, 81% of our greenhouse gas emissions are associated with the emission of carbon dioxide, which is almost entirely connected to the combustion of fossil fuel. So there's no way to reduce our carbon footprint as a country unless we address our consumption of fossil fuel. This is just showing you the general trajectory of U.S. emissions over time, and we have reduced about 11%, let's say, from 2005, and our goal that we set at Paris was 26% to 28%. So we're about halfway there, and maybe we'll achieve it just with the measures that we have underway. This just shows you that here are the two big dogs, right? Transportation, the combustion of fossil fuel and transportation, and the combustion of fossil fuel in the electric power sector. This is coal, this is natural gas. In another 2 years, it'll be more like this in terms of the relative share. But, here's our homes, which are still significant, but these are the two big boys that are the big challenge, and especially transportation. How do we replace the energy density in a gallon of gasoline or a gallon of diesel fuel? It's really hard. But anyway, we have other ways to make electricity. Witness the Holden's Hydro plant. In 2015, the international community came together in Paris and said, yep, we got a serious problem here with all these greenhouse gas emissions. They took a new approach. They said, instead of us telling you how much you should reduce, why don't you tell us how much you think you can reduce? That brought every nation in the world to the table. That's not That's not insignificant. You don't get everybody to the table easily. And yet they did. And they all made initial national INDC something contribution. and add them all up. And unfortunately, the planet is still scheduled to warm to 3.3 degrees Celsius. Scientists say we could stand to increase no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius. The trajectory we're on is here. And that's if these voluntary commitments are lived up to. If we don't, we're on our way to that. The analogy I gave the other day is think about how miserable you feel when you have a fever of 100 degrees. Hard to function. And then think about how miserable you are when you have a fever of 104 degrees. So the planet has a fever, and this is another way of looking at it. This is where we are right now in terms of where we might be heading. And this is if we can't get our act together. And the bottom line is what we're experiencing is a rate of warming that is unprecedented in the 10,000 years of human history. Human beings can adapt just like other species, but we're talking about a rate to which you have to adapt that is unprecedented in the evolutionary history of our species. That's why I think this is the most important issue facing us. It's the great threat multiplier. It makes every social justice problem worse and, of course, adds many more. Yes?
Are you going to say anything about the Anthropocene, you know, the language that captures
I wasn't going to, but I certainly will. The reality is most of what we understand as of human history and human civilization is no more than 10,000 years old since the advent of agriculture. And that took place during a period of a geological period called the Holocene. But geologists, earth scientists recently have met and decided that we are now living in a new geological age called the Anthropocene. And the hallmark of the Anthropocene is that the planet has now been so affected by the cumulative impact of human production, reproduction, and consumption that you can literally see the effect in the rock layers around the world. And in many of those places, that rock layer is distinguished by a layer of plastic. But there are other markers as well. So I'm borrowing this, two or three of us in this volume borrowed Martin Luther King's famous line that the fierce urgency of now. We are now faced with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. This is the rest of the quote. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. Procrastination is still the thief of time. Life often leaves us standing bare, naked, and dejected with a lost opportunity. The tide in the affairs of men does not remain at flood, it ebbs. We may cry out desperately for time to pause in her passage, but time is adamant to every plea and rushes on. Over the bleached bones and jumbled residues of numerous civilizations are written the pathetic words, too late. Martin was saying this about racism, poverty, in militarism in 1967. You tell me if you think Bonhoeffer, that King wouldn't be saying the same things today, looking at the data we have about climate change. Bonhoeffer is another famous, you know, poster quote. Just like Dorothy Day, she's got lots of great lines. Bonhoeffer does too. Silence in the face of evil is itself evil. God will not hold us guiltless. Not to speak is to speak. Not to act is to act. And this is a paraphrase of a famous line of Bonhoeffer's. The test of the morality of a society is what it does for its children. We've been talking about the other this week. I want to submit to you that another member of the other are future generations. They are invisible to us, except for those of us who have children and grandchildren. But in general, we don't really think about our obligations to future generations. And the reality is what's happening atmospherically on our planet is going to change the conditions of life for our species and every other species in the decades and centuries and millennia ahead.
So I think Bonhoeffer would look at this, and he was very, one of the reasons he participated in the conspiracy was his concern for future generations, so that future generations didn't grow up under tyranny and brutality. So that brings me then to the last part of this presentation, a spoke in the wheel, systemic change, and civil disobedience. How do we change the course we're on? I said earlier that we're trapped in this economy, this fossil fuel infrastructure that drives the almost all economic activity on the planet. How do we get off of it? Well, this is a great poster from 350.org, an organization linked with Bill McKibben, but lots of wonderful activists. 350, remember that 1.5 degrees of warming, that's associated with 350 parts per million by volume of carbon dioxide equivalent in the atmosphere. So how do we get there? I'm going to offer, I think it's five ways, but there are more ways than this. But how do we stick a spoke in the wheel? How do we change the status quo? Here we have, how many of you have marched in any kind of protest? Raise your hands. How many of you marched joined a march for climate policy? Okay, so that's what this picture is taken from. These are all members of a union. I don't know what SEIU is.
Service Employees International Union.
You were in that union? Well, anyway, it's a nice, it's a great picture. Okay, so that's definitely one thing we can do. And if you do it in D.C., ideally when Congress is in session, maybe those people will see you and maybe they'll even want to talk to you. Anybody heard of this guy, Tim DeChristopher? We're seeing this video, Bitter 70. So this guy, every so often, the federal government leases land on federal land for oil and gas exploration. So this guy shows up, and it's a bidding affair. And he shows up and sits down, and you know, you're there to bid for Exxon, and you're there to bid for, you know, Halliburton or whatever. And he sits down right here, and the guy's going, okay, what do we got on lot number 242? And Tim's got his panel up, you know, me, I'll bid, you know, whatever the amount is. And then you bid something, he's got his hand up. He wins the bid on at least one parcel. I can't remember how many parcels he bid on. Of course, he didn't have a single dime. He had no money. And that turns out is against the law. You're engaged in fraudulent activity. And for it, he was sentenced to jail. And he spent, I think it was like 2 years in jail. He did it. Now, he knew darn well that what he was doing wasn't going to stop oil and gas exploration near these two national monuments. He did it to draw attention to the fact that the federal government is leasing land for oil and gas drilling near these federal monuments. And, you know, I think he's successful because look at what's happening right now. I'm talking about him to you. And there are thousands of other people doing the same thing. So that's his reason. That's what he's trying to achieve. It's not to bring an end to the fossil fuel industry in the United States. It's to lift up in front of the eyes of people that something's got to change, and I'm willing to pay the price, like Dorothy Day, to go to prison to make that point. Here's another one. There's the same guy. he's laying down. This is a pipeline.
We know that.
Pardon?
This group's in our state.
This is your state. Okay, so all right, so this is a pipeline carrying natural gas derived from the practice of what's called hydraulic fracturing to the eastern seaboard, you know, consumption sites. My house is heated with natural gas. Who else has their house heated with natural gas? Okay. 70% of the molecules in the Midwest that are combusted in my boiler, our boiler, are from fracked wells. Lots of concern about hydraulic fracturing in terms of polluting groundwater, drinking water, causing earthquakes, noise pollution, etc. These two, Karenna Gore is the daughter of Al Gore, decided we want to try to stop this pipeline from being built. Did they stop it? No.
This was the day after, actually, we were at the same spot. The real problem here, I mean, above and beyond frack gas and all that, was this thing was running right down the middle of the street in a densely populated neighborhood. Not a wealthy neighborhood, naturally.
Yeah, right. So here now, what they're trying to do is make the rest of us feel the pain. Because if that pipeline doesn't go in, then maybe there's that much less gas, and that means the price of gas goes up, and pretty soon you start squealing because you're going to burn all the gas you need in the dead of winter in the Northeast or in the Midwest or wherever you are. You just got to pay it. You're not going to be happy about it. So they're trying to call attention to this through economic disruption, to open the eyes of Americans to our addiction to fossil fuel. And then there are these two, Jessica Resnick and Ruby Montoya. They're from Iowa. They're members of the Catholic Worker House in Des Moines. They took tools and incendiary devices and burned this bulldozer and gouged holes in the pipeline. Now, the pipeline wasn't filled with petroleum or anything at that point. And they did it kind of in the spirit of Edward Abbey and the Monkey Wrench Gang to take it a little further, not only to call public attention to it, but to actually cause physical economic constraint to the distribution of fossil fuel. And they were arrested. In this last legislative session, the state of Iowa passed a law that made what they did a felony, punishable for multiple years in prison. This is my last slide. How should we respond to the climate question? Civic duty. I think, don't we all agree? Yep. Ask the state if it's doing enough. Humanitarian service. In a previous version of this, I showed a bunch of slides from Lutheran Disaster Response and Lutheran World Relief, and of course, hosts of other relief organizations. Should we be helping people who are the victims of climate change? Of course. Of course we should. And let me tell you, it's going to be a bigger toll on our wallets and our faithfulness. Is that enough? And what Bonhoeffer decided was in Nazi Germany. Now, let's be clear, right? These are not the same situations. We do not live under a totalitarian regime. We live in a democracy. I believe we live in a democracy. I'm not willing to say we live in an oligarchy, even though money plays a huge role in politics. So it's not the same thing. And I'm not suggesting at all, there's no lethal, violent option here that I have listed as morally acceptable. But I do think there are members of the Christian community that think these are acceptable. And then I said other ideas. Was denkst du? What do you think? Eric and Halifa? Yeah, yeah.
I want to add a bullet point.
Yeah, great.
And between number two and number three, and that is to say proactive, climate-friendly actions on the part of congregations and faith communities. Recently, this doesn't fall under civil disobedience. This is a whole different bullet point.
Okay, fine, yeah.
So, recently our congregation installed a 12-volt solar power system. During the summer, we're using 1 volt of power at one
kilowatt?
Yeah, 1 kilowatt, thank you. 12 kilowatt system, we're using 1 kilowatt. Those eight, nine, ten other ones are going back into the grid. They're being used by our neighbors in the Seattle area. So that's a proactive thing that we could do, we have done.
It's public witness.
And it's making a public witness. People see the solar going up, et cetera. And We also, as an individual family, we have an option in Seattle. You can choose to support, subsidize green energy within the city. So you can say, I'll pay a little bit extra in order to support those fossil fuel alternative technologies, and you're going to say, I'm going to subscribe to these other technologies when it comes to heating my house. So that helps to support the infrastructure of those. Mm-hmm. So, and I mean, those are just two examples, but I
sure.
think that's a whole class of things that can be done, should be done.
At the congregational level and at the individual yes. level, you can buy hybrid vehicles, we can buy electric, you should be buying electric vehicles out here if you're plugging into a wall out with all the hydro you have. I have a friend in Decorah, now he's 70, I think, and he's a retired banker, and he's seen the world, but he and his wife have decided they're not going to fly anywhere anymore. Period. So there's a pretty radical, you know, way of reducing your personal carbon footprint. So there are things we can do individually, personally, to reduce our carbon footprint. There are things we can do as congregations to witness to society that we can live in a way without the use of fossil fuels. But I'm going to keep pushing the point here. Is that enough? And Bonhoeffer is getting after the systemic government policy part of it. Alifa?
Well, I was just going to say, I think that you civil disobedience and the protests and things, yes. And I think church needs to take, especially Protestant church, I mean, Pope Francis did take a very strong stand that was very radical. And when he came to the United States, he was very radical.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just would like to see more church leaders call some of these things out, because, I mean, I don't know that because Pope Francis said that changed every Catholic or anything, but at least you've got the leader of a large church speaking very strongly.
Okay, so at least the leaders of our religious or Christian communities, or religious communities, should be taking a strong stand one way or the other. There was a hand here. Yes, Asaph.
As organizations, churches have the power to boycott and start determining where these organizations are that are profiting by continuing to disrupt our environment. And start boycotting, you know, getting where they hurt. It's perfectly legal and perfectly reasonable.
So, and insofar, the boycott piece, I think, kind of falls into this one, nonviolent economic disruption. Yeah. Other ideas? Yeah, Jeff?
I want to speak in favor of the congregation level action for another reason, that you want people to get used to doing something that's just beyond the individual level.
Yeah.
That it's sort of the first order of collective action where you're theoretically in an organization where everybody loves each other.
Yeah.
And let's try this together and let's see what happens when we do this collective thing. Oh, that worked. And then you have maybe a little more self-efficacy, group efficacy about what should we do next. So I like it as sort of a training space to get beyond yourself in a relatively safe way to do some group action with people about whom you don't have very many doubts.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a bullet, just reinforcing what Eric is saying.
I did want to say, if we have time, something about the Massachusetts. The Roxbury is the pipeline in eastern Massachusetts. There's a pipeline in western Massachusetts where there's been a lot of civil disobedience and hundreds of people have been arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And those pipelines, at least from what I've been told by people I respect, really the gas is going overseas.
Mm.
So it's nothing to do with, and that they don't need it in New, they definitely do not need natural gas in New England. Most of New England AC isn't even set up for natural gas. And
right. Fuel oil.
Well, yeah, a lot of people still have wood in the rural parts and
So
they were saying, and they're building these pipelines through, like one is going through a very dense, poor neighborhood. The other one's going through the most pristine piece of land in Massachusetts, some of the oldest forests.
Mm-hmm.
And the state said no, and feds overrode them. So that's...
So the FCC overrode the state?
FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Yeah.
Just overrode the state and said sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, we have that problem in Iowa where local counties want to prevent big hog producers from setting up shop.
but they've technically fulfilled the matrix in the state of Iowa, and so the Iowa Department of Natural Resources stamps it. Up they go, despite the what the county level wants. Karen?
Well, that chart you showed the other day showed that climate change is way down on the list.
Yeah.
People think are the most important issues.
Right.
And we've commented watching the national news how often weather is a top story,
mm-hmm.
how seldom they use the word climate change.
Yeah.
Like the West is burning and Houston is flooding. And
right.
They never go deeper.
Right.
And I guess, you know, we get all the presidential candidates that come through Iowa. They never talk about this. I mean, what does it take to get it into the mindset of people and into politicians' mouths? That seems to me.
And that's what these folks are trying to do. You know, they're trying to answer that question. You know, what does it take? Well, they're doing these things to get your attention, to try to get public attention.
Hear about, I didn't know. A slim number of people hear those stories because it's liberal media, fake news.
And maybe it's because only it's a few of them. What if it were more of us? You know, I'll be honest. Go ahead. I don't need to shoot my mouth.
I guess I want to put in a word for all the various interfaith ecumenical organizations that are really working and waiting for the churches, the members of their networks to step up. It's not like the individuals, oh dear, we have to think about going out here and sitting.
Yeah.
They are already working with the legislature.
Yep.
They're calling upon us in our congregations to join them in our state capitals. Or we can see the advocacy efforts of the ELCA. I get a news email.
Yep.
And there is our presiding bishop inviting us now to stand up and speak out, to go to the oil fields, to wherever she is.
Yeah.
And it's not like this is a foreign thing to us, but there are avenues right there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You bet. You bet there are. Yeah. Yeah, what I was going to say is that sometimes I feel like, you know, folks that are doing this sort of thing, it's more about them than it is about the issue. They got this hero complex, and most of them probably drove to the site where they're going to get arrested, right? So there's this sort of hypocrisy in terms of using the fuel. But then I step back from it and I say to myself, now, Jim, what you just told people earlier is we're all enmeshed in this economy that is fueled by fossil fuels. Well, that's not their fault, and it isn't their fault. You know, Karen and I, we've invested in the most energy efficient boiler we can. We put brand new windows in our house. You know, we put insulation in the attic. I've spent most of the last 20 years working on renewable energy projects for Luther College and in our county. I'm proud of what we've accomplished there, but I showed you those graphs, and those numbers are not, they're going the wrong direction. And so I find myself asking myself, when do I have to step out of my comfort zone and do something that is truly countercultural?
I really don't want to go to jail.
Yeah. It doesn't have a whole lot to commend it. Anybody been in jail? Yeah, that might be a little awkward for somebody. Yeah, got caught doing something wrong. Yeah, totally. Because it might be uncomfortable. B, because you'll be a social pariah, right, to some extent, in your family or in your community. What was that?
Not my family. They don't be there bringing me meals.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Well, what are you waiting for then? Well, anyway, I'm just trying to challenge you, I guess, to do you agree that climate change is the most pressing issue facing us today? I mean, it doesn't mean that, you know, we can have a multiplicity of grave problems, right? But in my view, this is the one that is going to exacerbate every existing ethical issue. And frankly, at the rate we're going, a great deal of life on Earth will perish. And I'm grateful for the diversity of creation. I love it. I'm My brother, who's not a Christian, once said something at dinner that just made my jaw drop in terms of his affirmation, A, of the gift of life, and more importantly, the uniqueness of the human species, because he said, we are the only part of the universe that is aware of it, to our knowledge. Maybe our dog, Ida, was aware of the universe. But, you know, there is so much that is on the precipice of death that it just doesn't seem right to just go on with business as usual. And so I think this is what Bonhoeffer understood, was you get to a point where it has to stop. Something has to change. Now, it's not what he did is not the same, you know, to the issue we face. But I'm trying to encourage you to think that what is needed is more than personal responsibility, more than corporate congregational responsibility. What is needed is a change in government policy that gets at systemic issues. I thoroughly believe that it's both ends are in relationship with each other, that what we do as individuals in terms of our individual righteousness and you know stewardship matters a great deal, and that drives our advocacy and public policy, and at the same time, I think public policy shapes the options we have in society. I would love to drive an electric car that got 400 miles a gallon, but I can't find one of those. I can't afford a Tesla. So those things are always going to be in relationship with each other. But I guess what I just think the situation is dire enough that we have got to start looking at the bigger systemic picture and trying to move that needle in the right direction, because time is limited. So it's 5, and I want to respect people's time. If you want to just boogie out of here, great. Eric's got a question. He and I went to college together, so he gets to.
Well, it's more of a comment, and that is where does the will and the energy to mount challenges against these, you know, huge questions come from? I want to make an argument that our congregations are places where that can aid and abet that that's where the Spirit can energize
Absolutely.
Us. And that everyone who's here, if your congregation isn't addressing these kinds of issues theologically or in your worship life, that they haven't made their way into your worship life, then how can your children or grandchildren find the theological, spiritual energy to move on these? So I just want to make an argument that our worship life as communities of faith are critical to this. This is not something divorced from our life as, you know, as people of faith. This, we should have incubators working on this, and it has to touch our liturgical, our worship life in order to be able to unleash the power of community.
Well said. Well said. Any other comments, or yeah, Alifa?
I mean, you didn't have an exact backup, and I don't have the exact numbers in my head, but I can't help but think we have to push ourselves even more, because for the percentage of the world's population, we're way off the chart of music.
In terms of the carbon emissions per capita, absolutely, absolutely.
I mean, it would, for America to change, that'd be a huge change throughout the whole planet. I mean, if we could just change our own country.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's even more probably on us right now.
Yeah, I'm always really inspired by Martin Luther King and his witness. And the reality is, right, civil rights, the only reason we have it is because political pressure forced Congress and Lyndon Johnson to finally get the Voting Rights Act passed. And that was due to enormous amounts of public pressure over many years that grew out of Christian communities, wasn't only in Christian communities, and was the result of leadership and training, courage, and the willingness to engage in civil disobedience, to break the law, to establish justice. And, you know, I'm pretty sure I'm not Martin Luther King, but boy, if any of you are ready to step up, that would be great. I really think we need that. I think that's the kind of level of commitment and organization that we need. So thanks very much. Sorry I got a little emotional there, but I care a lot about this topic. So thanks.